And good afternoon. May it please the court, Lauren Whitley on behalf of Mr. Garcia. Mr. Garcia's petition was granted on four assignments of error. With the court's permission, I'd actually like to start with the fourth that was listed in our brief.
To your time.
Which goes to the insufficient evidence of the actual date, the specific date that the Commonwealth was charged with proving Mr. Garcia was not present. And that date is July 1, 2005, as stated in the indictment. And even in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the evidence at trial, at best, was that Mr. Garcia was not present on a date in July of 2005. The officer in the case, Colorado, stated, and that this is at the appendix at page 84, in 2005, I believe, there was two or three times that I appeared in court regarding this case. At appendix at 83, he testifies he was in Fairfax.
What about the bench warrant?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What about the bench warrant?
Well, Your Honor, that's not evidence. And that was not presented as the capias itself was not presented as evidence in this case. And I would certainly highlight that if a bench warrant in and of itself established an element of the offense, then we would have a very difficult time defending against failures to appear. The testimony, both from Officer Colorado as well as from Ms. Velasquez, was there was a court date in July of 2005. Officer Colorado wasn't sure if that was in the General District Court or the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court. Ms. Velasquez stated it was in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court. And neither of them testified to the specific date. Ms. Officer Colorado, I believe, articulated I didn't memorize the specific dates. Ms. Velasquez said she appeared in the juvenile court in July of 2005. There were no further specifics elicited from the Commonwealth or testified to by either of those witnesses. And the date is a very important part and element of the Commonwealth's case with a failure to appear. And I would point the court to Hunter against Commonwealth from this court in 1993. When the government proves that an accused received timely notice of when and where to appear for trial and thereafter does not appear on the date or place specified, the fact finder can infer that failure to appear. And here the problem for the Commonwealth is they did not specify the date that they were speaking to and that Mr. Garcia was not present for that date. So I can move on to I was going to move on up to the third assignment, which deals with insufficient evidence of notice for Mr. Garcia, and this ties a little bit into our arguments about the bond recognizance documents. The third assignment of error is that there was no proof of actual notice to Mr. Garcia. And this really goes to the fact that the bond recognizance documents that came in had Mr. Garcia's information. They had the information about the court date and about the case in particular. And there was a signature that stated Tony Garcia on that document.
Is it your position your client didn't sign that?
There's no evidence that he did in the record. So nobody...
So an imposter came in.
We don't know. And I think that there's a number of ways the Commonwealth could have established that. And I pointed in my reply brief, one of those was...
But we don't have direct evidence because we don't have a witness who came and said, I remember him. He signed it. But, I mean, a judge can draw reasonable inferences. And, yes, there are people who falsify public records, but ordinarily not in the courtroom in front of the judge. It seems like a low probability event. In light of the other corroborating evidence, why isn't that enough?
Well, there's no evidence. There's not even circumstantial evidence. So the difficulty here is we don't even have someone from a custodian perspective coming in and saying, this is how we sign bond recognizance forms in Fairfax County.
How did this imposter know to write your client's name on there?
Well, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to...
How did they know, well, I'm going to write this name who just happens to be...
Well, I mean, to be fair, to go down that road, you know, his information has been typed into the form by someone. But the problem for the Commonwealth here is that they don't even have someone who says, this is the course of how we do things when we do a bond recognizance form. The defendant comes out from behind, you know, the jail. A lot of times this actually doesn't happen in court in Fairfax County. We present the form to him. It's already filled out with the date and time and the information of his next court date. That's one piece of information we don't know. He may have signed a blank form that was later filled in by the clerk's office. We also don't have anyone who can otherwise authenticate his signature. So there's certainly situations where you could introduce a document where it's the witness can testify it being Mr. Garcia's signature if he's self-admitted.
What evidence would authenticate the signature?
Well, in my reply brief, I cite to Bain, which is a case that talks exactly about that, about authentication. And in Bain, it was dealing with loan documents, and the Virginia Supreme Court found that there was sufficient evidence that the defendant had signed it because the defendant negotiated the loan prior to preparation. There was testimony. The defendant presented the loan or was presented with the loan documents when they were prepared. The defendant received the benefit of the loan documents.
But didn't the defendant in that case say, I didn't sign it?
In Bain, actually, Your Honor, I don't recollect. That may have been the case.
I think he did.
But I think that there is circumstantial evidence that could have been presented, such as in Bain, to establish the authentication of Mr. Garcia or to establish that it was his signature. We don't have anything like that in this case. And we don't even have anyone coming in to say, as I stated, this is the procedure in Fairfax County. This is how we do this. That's pretty simple, to have a custodian or a clerk or someone who works with the magistrate judges to come up and testify to that. So we have a document.
And maybe this is not proper judicial notice, and there's no indication that this judge took judicial notice, but I mean, one would think the judges would be familiar with that process in that locality.
Well, this was a jury trial, so I don't think that's a fair inference to make when you're talking about fact finders
fair
who are
enough.
Sitting as jurors. And I think that's a dangerous avenue to go down, especially when there's a case, it's unpublished from this court, but Burke against Commonwealth, where this court specifically rejected that type of, this is the practice of the court argument. So in Burke, they had a general district court form. The Commonwealth only presented that form to prove the failure to appear and then argued to the trial judge, well, that's the practice of this court, is to present that form to the defendant. And this court said no, because there's no evidence that the defendant actually saw that form. And that's really what we have here.
I understand your point, but it appears to me from the record and looking at the actual documents, the arrest warrant and the recognizance are dated the same day. They're apparently processed together, if you will, I guess for lack of a better way to phrase it. And I understand your assertion that the signature on the recognizance, which contains the date he was to appear in court, might not be him, but the accompanying warrant lists a lot of personal identifying information, date of birth, you know, so forth, height, weight. Why is it unreasonable for the court for us to look at those, or for any fact finder to look at those documents in their totality as opposed to isolating them individually?
Well, I think one of the differences I'd point out is that the arrest warrant was actually issued on May 13th and served on him, it looks like, on May 13th from the face of the document. The bond recognizance form, the signature that's listed is May 16th, 2015. And I think the danger there is we're talking about what is a reasonable inference from the evidence in the record. And I think that the difference, so there's a May 16th date on the side and a notation on the warrant that's unclear from the record. There's no testimony about what that date means, what that date is referenced. And what Your Honor is asking is to make an inference based on facts that aren't in the record. No one testified. There was no judicial notice taken of the notations on the side of the document on the arrest warrant. Nobody testified as to who wrote that, when it was written, what those things mean, to be fair. And to make that inference, I think, is not a reasonable inference when we're talking about proving an element beyond a reasonable doubt. And so that's really what we're talking about when we discuss this under assignment number 3, is that there wasn't that evidence before the court that Mr. Garcia knew about his court date and that they had established that link for him to be present on July 1st, 2005. The first two assignments of error are directly to the admissibility of the bond recognizance form. It really kind of dovetails into that sufficiency argument because it's really about whether they established the bond form was relevant, because they never established Mr. Garcia had seen the document or in fact signed it, despite the information.
So it kind of folds into some of the...
It really does, right. And I think certainly if this court finds that the bond recognizant form was admitted in error, then the Commonwealth's evidence is clearly insufficient on both points, both for the date and for the actual notice to Mr. Garcia. So those are... Yes.
Do I correctly understand your basis for asserting it shouldn't have been admitted was insufficient foundation, or I mean, it's because it's obviously, it's if it's properly certified, it's admissible, and it was certified, it's admissible if it's relevant.
Right. So I think there were two. Under assignment one, the challenge was to the foundation as far as the relevance, that it wasn't relevant to a theory of the Commonwealth's case because they hadn't connected it to Mr. Garcia. And then assignment number two was about the, going to a material point at issue, again, kind of around that idea that Mr. Garcia had not been connected directly to the document. Authentication was not challenged on appeal. There was a footnote about that. It was a self-authenticated, essentially, document by being a judicial record, in a way.
I was a little confused because the appendix doesn't contain any certification by the clerk, which is required, but the original does. So.
Right. And I don't think that was anything that I think there was a footnote by my predecessor who wrote the brief that we weren't challenging the authentication. It was about the relevance and the connection to the case here today.
Right.
I'm happy to answer any other questions, but those are our arguments.
Extra rebuttal time.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. Good afternoon, Your Honors. There's four assignments of error in this case, but I think it can be summed up in two main issues related to the evidentiary issue and the sufficiency issue. Turning first to the evidentiary issue, the Commonwealth's position is that the trial court properly admitted the bond recognizance document because it was properly authenticated and as a court record, and it was clearly relevant to a material issue at hand in this case. As this court is also aware, the standard of review is abuse of discretion, and this court only...
And I think really the nub of it is what reasonable... nobody disputes what the evidence is. It's a simple, clear record. So really the question... And there's no direct testimony about signatures, et cetera. So really it becomes a line drawing of how much is reasonable inferences from what's in front of the court. Is that right?
Reasonable inferences from the document?
From the totality of the evidence presented.
I think so, Your Honor, but I think most of the challenges that the defendant is raising to this document are weight issues. They're not admissible.
Well, it's not just the document. For example, your opponent is correct that the witnesses didn't specify what date he didn't appear, except that it was sometime in July of 2005, I think.
Correct.
And is that close enough for government work when you're charging somebody with a crime for not appearing if you can't pin the date down of their failure to appear any better than that?
Okay, sure, Your Honor. Turning to the sufficiency issue, I think with the date, I would point out first that 10 years had passed since this had occurred. Both witnesses testified that it was definitely one court date in July. It's not that they testified to an incorrect court date. They just, so much time had passed that they weren't good at being very specific. But all the evidence was that it was this one court date in July, and based on the evidence that was, these two documents were entered into evidence at trial as exhibits, so they are evidence in this case. And based on these exhibits, his one court date was July 1. He had notice of it. And based on these notations entered into evidence, the trial court said on July 1, 2005, the defendant failed to appear and issued a capias. And I argued at the end of my brief that this court presumes that officials are discharging their duties properly. And unless there's any...
Well, then do we even need to worry about the witnesses in this case? In other words, let's assume that nobody had testified and all we had were these documents. One saying he's recognized to appear on July 1st, and the other a warrant showing a notation by the court that he did not appear on July 1st. Would that be enough to convict standing alone?
The Commonwealth would submit that it would be enough based on that alone, but that the witnesses in this case helped corroborate that testimony, and they also corroborated the fact that they knew who the defendant was. They could testify that he was who he was in court. He was the same person that had been arrested on this arrest warrant. So they corroborated and kind of circled back to all the evidence. So perhaps they were not 100% necessary, but they certainly bolstered the case and made this beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant was guilty of failing to appear on July 1st, 2005. So switching back to the evidentiary issue, I think it's very clear that this document is relevant to the material issue at hand. The only issue at hand is whether or not, one of the only issues at hand is whether or not he had notice to appear on July 1st. This document goes to the heart of that, that he was out on bond, that he was told he may not leave the Commonwealth, that he had to appear on this date. It has his case number. It has the same case number as the arrest warrant. It has his name and his signature. And any objection to the signature is a weight issue. It is not an admissibility issue. And turning to the sufficiency, the second part, the two assignment of errors, they are the notice and whether or not he actually did not appear on the correct date. The Commonwealth submits that taking the evidence as a totality of the witnesses and these two documents, it is clear that he had notice and he did not appear on that date. There is no evidence to the contrary. Therefore, unless the court has any questions, the Commonwealth would submit on its brief and ask you to affirm the conviction.
Thank you.
And I would just briefly highlight one thing, which is I certainly don't think that a capias with a bond recognizance form would ever be sufficient for a criminal offense, especially when we're talking about a class six felony that goes anywhere from 5 years to up to 5 years of incarceration.
If the recognizance is admissible, is it still your position that the evidence is an insufficient evidence for a judge to reasonably convict this man?
Yes. Yes, and specifically with that, our argument about the notice gets a little tougher, but the argument with regards to the specific date still stands. And I think that is something the Commonwealth did have to prove. Their witnesses, and again, not to do the Commonwealth's job, it's refreshing recollection is an easy manner at trial to do that. Did you take notes, officer, when you came to court? Did you take notes about
just
whether he was
abstract,
there?
Let me maybe take a little bit of issue with the statement you just made. In the abstract, if you had a set of documents, individual documents, that collectively established a fact, you don't necessarily need live witnesses, you know, do you? I mean, in other words, you know, if you have, in this context, you have a bond recognizance that says you have notice to appear, Mr. Garcia, you're notified to appear on July 1st, 2005. And then you have another court document with a notation by the court itself that he did not appear on that date. And if the fact you're trying to establish was that he had notice to appear and did not appear, tell us why those two documents taken together, assuming they were admissible in the first place, would not be sufficient.
Well, I think then you're dealing with a difficulty where the exception subsumes the rule. So the exception there, right, is judicial records are accurate, and we presume the regularity and accuracy under that hearsay exception. But when you're talking about proving an element of the offense, either actual notice or willful failure to appear, you're relying on that exception then to prove that element. And I think that's an error. I think that would be in violation of the Constitution. That would be my argument in that situation.
Okay.
So if there are no further questions, those are arguments. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentations. We'll